Good afternoon and welcome to Corporations and Democracy for November 14th, 2017. This is the program that examines how corporations dominate our democracy and what citizens are doing to replace corporate dominance with true democracy. I'm Steve Scaminini with co-host Annie Esposito. The opinions expressed on Corporations and Democracy are those of our guests and the hosts and not necessarily of the management of Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Today's topic is the new economy and the quietly emerging next system. This is the title of a presentation given by our guest, Gar Alperovitz, a month ago at a conference which caught our attention. It's a good way to update listeners on the topic since Gar was on our program about 8 years ago. Plenty of progress has ensued on the new economy since then. So today, let's have a look at what's new in recent years. Our guest again is Gar Alperovitz. He's had a distinguished career as a historian, political economist, activist, writer, and government official. After a master's degree at the University of California at Berkeley and a PhD in political economy as a Marshall Scholar at Cambridge University, he served as a legislative director in both houses of Congress and as a special assistant in the State Department. For 15 years, he served as a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland, and is a former fellow of King's College, Cambridge University. He's worked at the Harvard's Institute of Politics, the Institute for Policy Studies, and a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution. He's currently the co-director of the Next System Project, which began 5 years ago, and that is a project of the Democracy Collaborative, which he co-founded some years earlier. So let's look at what's happening with the new economy and the quietly emerging next system. Gar Alperovitz, welcome to Corporations and Democracy.
Oh, glad to be with you. Thanks for having me.
What I'm hoping to do today is discuss a number of points that you made in your presentation. This was a month ago at the Vermont Law School. And then with particular emphasis on what trends have been in recent years. So what are people actually doing regarding the new economy and the new system. And so for starters, you talked about how to the need to change the whole system if you want to change trends. Can you expand on that a little for us?
Well, I think it's, in one sense, it's fairly straightforward and obvious. The current political economy is generating growing income inequality. The trends are very powerful. The top 1% is the top 400 people now have. This is an astounding figure, which is important to think about. Mm-hmm. They have more wealth, the top 400 individuals. You could get them in a classroom or a small church. More wealth than the bottom 185 million Americans. Now, that's a medieval number.
Mm-hmm.
Except I once gave that figure in a public discussion, and a medieval historian came up to me and he said it was never that concentrated.
No kidding.
Yeah. Well, it's a very, you know, that means that the wealth of the society has been concentrated in a very small number of people and in the large corporations that they largely dominate. So it's very much a situation which is antagonistic to any really serious idea of democracy. And it's straightforward in the numbers. It's not rhetorical. It's basically you can just look at the numbers and then you can see the implications.
Mm-hmm.
I think people are kind of overwhelmed by the idea of creating a new system, but you're a part historian along with your other talents, and you say this happens as common as grass?
Yeah, maybe that's a slight exaggeration, common as grass, but systems do come and go. You know, the medieval system, which was the entire world, is gone. You can't find it except in fragments that look something like it in a few backward countries. So something happened that made that transformation occur. The transformation from agriculture in the beginning part of the pre-feudal era is another situation. In many parts of the world, something like social democracy, or which means capitalism, with a lot of social programs. The typical welfare state of Sweden, which is it is capitalist, but it doesn't look like American capitalism, is a different system, a different design. So So if you stand back from history, change is always occurring. And in that sense, I'm a historical optimist that I think there's reasons to believe the pain levels are growing in America. The discerning feeling about what's happening. It's not only the Trump era. The statistics on worry and fear and recognition that corporations dominate the economy existed before the Trump era. They've exaggerated now because of some of the more blatant kind of concentrations of power in the top offices of the government. You know, foundations of the government are kind of laid by corporate leadership now in many, many places. But it's there beforehand, and you can see it in the trends. I think the reaction we saw publicly to Bernie Sanders, a self-described democratic socialist, that nobody expected. I certainly didn't expect that overwhelming a response, particularly with the terminology of socialism, tells you that there's something bubbling up in the society that at least offers the possibility of a larger transformation over time. And I think we can see it, and we'll probably talk about this, in the all kinds of experiments developing around the country that suggest the basis of accumulating of experience that point in the direction of something that doesn't really look like corporate capitalism, and it doesn't even look like state socialism. It's, in my view, the beginning points, well-developed, actually, in many parts of the country, that suggest the direction for what you can only describe as the next system.
So you're asking people to think through how you could build it up to the next system and then do it.
Exactly, and that's what's happening around the country. One of the things, there are many, many examples of this. One is the growth of worker-owned co-ops. The co-ops have been around for a long time. I'm originally from Wisconsin, and there's a lot of co-op activity in that state and in the Midwest and the Scandinavian states like Minnesota. But now we're seeing cities around the country, from New York has got a program to foster and finance co-ops, worker co-ops. Rochester, Minnesota has got one. Rochester, New York has got one. There's a big one developing in Jackson, Mississippi. It's a phenomenon that's growing in many, many parts of the country. And what is it? It's a form of democratic ownership that is amongst co-ops, one person, one vote. So there's a great interest in that in happening spontaneously, and in one sense more than spontaneous, because people are learning from each other. And there are also complexes of worker-owned companies linked together with community-wide nonprofit corporations, so that you have not just individual co-ops, which in a sense begin to develop their own self-interest, but linking them in a community-building corporation. The most advanced is in Cleveland, Ohio, so that they kick back some of the money to the nonprofit, which represents the whole neighborhood, in this case 40,000-person black neighborhood. And then that money can be used either to help the neighborhood or to finance more worker-owned co-ops. So that's a very sophisticated design that's begun to develop. To take it one step further, the so-called Cleveland model, in the middle of that area, it's a very poor 40,000-person area of an average family income, about 20,000. It's a very poor black area. But in the middle of it are places like the Cleveland Clinic, which is one of the world's leading medical facilities. Case Western Reserve University is there, and another big hospital called University Hospitals. Well, they get a lot of public money. They get Medicare and Medicaid and direct grants and research grants, all from the federal taxpayer and the state taxpayer. Some of that is now being used in their purchasing power. They buy a lot of things, in fact, so they targeting their purchasing power to these co-ops in this complex that is a community-building worker co-op. So what you're getting is a kind of public policy and hospitals helping public policy basically to help stabilize this different form. And if you really stand back, and there are more experiments like that going on in Rochester, Minnesota, and also Jackson, Mississippi, Richmond, Virginia, a number of cities that are experimenting. The most advanced happens to be Cleveland. But if you think about that model, which is quasi-public money going through, in this case, hospitals, to support a community-wide nonprofit which is a joint venture with worker-owned co-ops aimed at building up the community. If it were national, you'd have public money. You know, we did nationalize General Motors, and we nationalized several banks, and Chrysler Corporation in the big crisis. You would have public purchasing for bigger things, maybe mass transit and high-speed rail, in, say, community and worker co-ops, building them. It's just a larger vision of the sort of thing that's happening on the ground in Cleveland. Now, I'm no utopian. I mean, obviously, that's not going to happen tomorrow. But we have had major crises where the government did, in fact, nationalize those big companies. And over time, I think the buildup of the things we're seeing on the ground, which are being driven by local pain, I think are beginning to give people ideas about the future of what might happen. You know, I'm from Wisconsin, which is a pretty liberal state, but I never imagined somebody calling themselves a democratic socialist would be so widely approved and accepted. The language of socialism is now acceptable in a very strange way.
It's not a dirty word anymore.
What's that?
It's not a dirty word anymore in the public media.
It isn't. It's quite, if you think about that, how did that happen? That is to say, it's a very good marker that consciousness can be opened, because at one point it was closed, and now there's been a development, and people can talk about it. And that's the same sort of thing about what's happening on the ground. You know, in, for instance, in Boulder, Colorado, they've taken over the utility, and there, as an organizing project, and made it into a public utility, primarily to deal with climate change. They wanted to change the way it was operating. So that's another example, in that case, not co-ops, but a different form of democratic ownership, a citywide utility, and with a different goal, not just poverty, but in this case, climate change. And you find, I mean, I can give you more and more examples. Public banks are publicly owned or city-owned banks are now on the agenda in many parts of the country. New Jersey just elected a new governor who is proposing a state-owned bank, which will be a socialist bank, essentially. In many parts of in Santa Fe, in Denver, and in Philadelphia, and in Oakland, and in Los Angeles, there are movements in many, many cities for city-owned banks. And, you know, the city's got a lot of taxpayer money. And instead of giving it to the big banks, who siphon it off to New York and Wall Street, it could be recycled locally. What do you do with it? To finance the sort of things, the co-ops and other things we're talking about. So it's called the New Economy Movement. There's an explosion of this stuff going on around the country that isn't covered by the press. Mainly because the local press is very, very, it's been devastated by the way the internet has provided news. So they're not interested very often because most of the local press is conservative. But two, they don't have the staff to do the kind of reporting on what's really happening just below the surface. And there's a huge amount going on all over the country that gives one a lot of hope and energy.
Another structure that you mentioned along with worker co-ops and public banks is land trusts.
Yeah, you know, land trust is another phenomenon. And what it is draw a circle around a neighborhood, just to make it simple, and set up a nonprofit corporation. And the purpose of that is to control land prices for a public purpose. Because if you don't do that, often what you get is the developers come in and begin bidding up the costs, and then people are just forced out. It's kind of forced emigration because the costs become so high. If you set up a land trust, it becomes a nonprofit corporation that can own and control the land, which owns and controls the cost of housing, and can stabilize rent and housing prices and costs in a neighborhood. So those are happening in many parts of the country. And my last count, I saw about 140 in recent years have been set up in different places with that goal. And some of them are longstanding. One of the things that again, going back to Bernie, he was very interesting as a mayor because he did all these things, 30 years ago in Burlington, Vermont, including a land trust in that city for the same kind of purposes.
You know, you talk about how important it is to have projects, but not to get caught in projectivism. So do you want to talk a little bit about how you go from your project to link it into something that's bigger with other groups?
That's a really important question. Thanks for bringing that up. Because what happens is people doing co-ops often, or at least sometimes, begin thinking co-ops are the only thing that matters. Or people doing land trusts. So this is my project is bigger than your project, or better. No, people are better than that, and I'm exaggerating a little bit. But we're getting to the point, and we can talk about there's a formal new economy movement that they had 1,000 people at their last meeting, which is a year and a half ago in Buffalo. 1,000 people who are doing this, you know, and they're representing many, many more who didn't get to that conference, big conference. These are practitioners who know how to do things rather than people simply talking about it now, and that's another stage of development. But one of the things standing back from it, and going back to your earlier question about changing the system, for one thing, systems come and go in history. They don't last, and we could kind of go into how feudalism went away from capitalism, came in, and some forms of state social. There's a complex development process historically that systems change. But if you look at these projects and begin to bring them together, they begin to define a kind of mosaic of different forms that could be the basis, and in fact begin to suggest what a next system might look like. It would include some co-ops, perhaps a lot of worker co-ops. It would probably include land trusts, neighborhood or city-owned land to control housing prices. It would probably have some public utilities, like the energy utilities, building up. At a higher level, it would probably, as in the nationalization of Chrysler and General Motors and AIG during the last crisis, you'd probably have ownership and control of the companies that build mass transit and high-speed rail. So you can begin to develop a picture, and even in this very big, big country, which is so gigantic, probably would be broken down ultimately in some form to regional administrations. So you can go back to the 30s and look at regional publicly owned entities like the Tennessee Valley Authority, which is a seven-state region, a huge energy and river kind of environment control, river control, non-profit public enterprise. Mm-hmm. It would have been one of the things that happened to TVA. It got caught up in World War II, so it became... its original design was aimed at much more democratic, but it got taken over during the war and the war effort. So it's not a perfect example, but there it is. It's a regional scale, very large public utility. So you can begin to see a mosaic. I actually think you folks are in California.
Mm-hmm.
I think that California is, you know, the most interesting state from this perspective, because it could really begin, and it already is beginning to develop all these elements, including consideration of a public bank. Right now there's movement for a public bank in many cities. Los Angeles and Oakland are the ones I've heard most about, but also in state government. You could imagine, and with the high-speed rail thing being developed and the conservation and the environmental kind of vision and history in California, you could imagine California taking the next step of really bringing together these kinds of experiments to create a whole positive developmental economy that points in the direction of really how you would run a nation. I mean, it is the sixth largest economy in the world, and it's very progressive, and I could imagine seeing some real regional development in the region called California. It would not surprise me, and I think, so let me suggest, I think that's a great project for folks to begin thinking about, taking the projects together that we know work all over the country, and say what would happen if we actually thought about, you know, the next 20 years in California, putting this all together and building a real complex. And I think that's, you know, as a historian,
Philo,
that looks to me like the next stage of development.
FM Willits in Ukiah.
Oh, I don't know. We've got a little interruption here, but continue.
Well, I was saying, if you know, I think of it as both a political economist and a historian. That's kind of how things work. If you begin to get, you know, the first experiment looks kind of strange to people, or the second one is kind of, well, maybe. But after a while, you see lots of them, and they begin to be more refined, more sophisticated. And then there are people who are movement builders and who are activists working with these developments. And pretty soon you can begin to, just as we're doing in this conversation, you can begin to sketch what begin to look like the fragments of a system at a different levels and a different scale, all of which are practical. And particularly with the last, I guess, CalExit kind of, at least the sentiment of regionalism, It would not be surprising to me if the state begins to do more and more of these projects and begins to develop a sense of its own autonomy. And whether or not that became some separatist or non-separatist movement is quite secondary, but it could be the possibility of a new California, bringing together all these things that are already on the table all over the country, with a vision, kind of a plan for the next 20 years of development. That's sort of the way these things work. After there's enough on the ground that people say, hey, that's real, then somebody or group of people begins to say, well, just let's put them together and see what the mosaic looks like, and begin to build a vision of something that's democratic, ecologically sustainable, nurtures communities, has a whole positive quality to it. I think that's a realistic way to think about historical change.
When it comes to environmentalism and immigration, California is certainly feeling very defiant against the national order. So, gee, I hope you have something there. It sounds great. One of the things that you've mentioned, land trusts, public banks, and co-ops, and what they all have in common, or one of the things they have in common, is they don't depend on growth. And you call that growth dependence as something, I think you use the adjective nasty.
Yeah, that's a very important point, particularly if you think about the next phase of development. Private corporations, particularly if they're big enough to have to go issue stock and go to Wall Street, they must grow. People don't often know this or think about it, actually. They probably know it, but they don't think about it. In order to keep their position in the economy, and particularly to keep the corporate leadership position, they have to show the stockholders regular growth. Otherwise, they'll be fired. It's that simple. So they're allowed to slip occasional quarter, but if they begin to fade off, they cannot raise capital in the capital markets of New York or London. So there's a continuous pressure on corporate capitalist firms, even if some of them felt differently about it, to keep driving growth, to keep getting ahead, keep going ahead. That's the nature of capitalism, particularly corporate capitalism. Small businesses in a stable market can be essentially stabilized. But if you're up against the growth pressures that come from trying to raise stock and keeping ahead of the game, and that has extremely destructive environmental implications, both in resource use and in trying to, you know, cut costs wherever you can in order to make profits, which often means polluting or destroying the environment in other ways because it saves money and there your stock prices go up. So that's a really nasty part of that. It's nobody trying to do that. The best people in the world on top of one of these corporations with the best attitudes and the best moral vision are forced by the logic of that system to do that. And unfortunately, the only way out of that is to establish some form of corporation that isn't dependent on growth to do that, to do the bigger jobs as well. It's not in that cycle. And we know something about that because we have large nonprofit hospitals versus profit-making hospitals. We know something about public utilities. We know something about the design of companies that don't have to grow inherently. Even the people who made the space kind of race work, public entities that were able to establish that. So we have some sense of that, and I think we're going to be experimenting more and more with at the larger levels when the next big crisis comes, and we did nationalize General Motors and Chrysler, and when the next and the big banks de facto. And I think as pain levels grow, the pendulum tends to swing. We've swung to Mr. Trump and his friends, but, you know, there may be a reaction to that at the next round. We may see much more experimentation. If you look what's happened in Britain, for instance, which is amazing things that are going on there, which our group actually had some part in some parts of it, like the Cleveland model I just mentioned briefly, has been picked up in Preston, a small city in England, where they're doing the same thing. And the British Labour Party has a big kind of program on what, quote, ownership. And it's really pretty much along the lines of everything we're talking about here, different scales, different structures for different scale. and beginning to generate a debate about the next, what I call the next system debate, which is one of the major parties, which may very well win the next election. The conservatives are in great trouble, and Labor is highly supported. Nobody would have predicted that a year ago, but in fact, that's where we are, with models on the ground and a very new public position being adopted by the Labor Party, and quite popular leadership, almost won this last election.
So politically, there's more momentum and visibility for these issues in the UK than over here in the U.S.
But all of a sudden, unexpectedly, and in part because of American experience, they really got excited about the Cleveland model.
Mm-hmm.
What my colleague, co-founder of the Center, the Democracy Collaborative, Ted Howard, was over there and speaking, and someone got turned on by it and began doing it very intensely and very cleverly in the city of Preston. And that's been picked up throughout the British press, and wham, it's a very exciting model, and labor unions, labor as an organization, began picking up on these diverse models of public utilities, neighborhoods, cooperatives, nationalization of some things, a whole array, no one model, but basically the principle is democratic ownership at different scales.
Mm-hmm.
So it's right at the heart of the Labor Party, and it wasn't there a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
These things can, they gather some excitement, and people see the point, and things happen very quickly sometimes.
So finally, some evidence that the Thatcher era is dead.
Hopefully. I think it is dead. There's something really happening and I think that one way to think about it is the future is to think the existing system and the way it's been operating is running out of alternatives, that it can't quite solve the problems that are generated by very large-scale concentrations of wealth and large corporations. And if it can't solve the problems, there's more pain levels, and there's more environmental difficulties, and exacerbates race problems. So systems have consequences, and people at first think you can't change the system. But after a while, piece by piece, people begin to get a sense that they could do things, and we shall see how far that goes. But there's a huge amount of activity on the ground of the kind we're talking about that most people just aren't aware of.
Mm-hmm. Let me take a moment to remind listeners that you're listening to Corporations and Democracy. Our topic today is the new economy and the quietly emerging next system. And we're speaking with Gar Alperovitz, co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative, author of several books on the new economy, by the way, that I didn't mention earlier. And we will have time for questions in the second half of the program. So if you'd like to call and get in on the conversation, the number here in area code 707 is 895-2448. Again, 895-2448.
One of the components that has kept us in balance somewhat has been the labor unions, and they've been losing ground rapidly and are about to really take a big hit from the Supreme Court next year. Do you want to talk a little bit about labor unions and what's happening?
Well, you're absolutely right to single that out. I mean, in the system that we've been living in technically is a weak form of social democracy. That's kind of, what is that? That's corporate capitalism as the central form, with certain things pasted on, progressive things. Medicare would be an obvious example. Some environmental regulations would be another obvious example. Sometimes poverty programs would be another example. So you can begin to see, but the heart of it is corporate capitalism, and to the degree of minimum wage policies, which kind of help ameliorate problems in that form. Usually, the architecture of corporate capitalism of this kind, social democracy, is big labor unions help produce a politics to take the edge off the harshness of a straight corporate system, and that's what we've been living with. It's ours is one of the weakest of the systems. I mean, if you look at Sweden, where the systems are of social welfare systems and hourly wage system, long-term vacations, environmental protections, daycare centers, free school, lots and lots free college education. That's kind of the extreme model of same design. But the difference is, in Sweden, they reached 80% of the labor force organized in unions, so that the political parties that represented social democracy, represented this model, were much, much, much more powerful, even though it's a corporate capitalist system. They counterbalanced the system and got much bigger results. Our labor unions, for complex reasons, partly because the country's so big and so hard to organize, let me say something about that. You could take Germany, the whole country, and drop it in Montana. Those are little countries. They're much easier to organize than this whole gigantic continental system. So it's hard to organize labor, for one thing. It's hard to organize unions compared with a small country. For another, the country is racially divided. And in the South, it was not only racially divided, it was divided up until, 1965, by the use of violence to put down black people. If you tried to vote, your house might be bombed, and many were. That system is very, very different from most countries. Now, it's changed some. It's certainly not like that, not that violent. But it's hard to organize labor unions, too. And in fact, most of the southern states were right-to-work states where you really couldn't organize unions. So it made the national system weaker as well as the regional system. So that whole kind of design of many countries, that the compromise, of, which was called social democracy or liberalism, I think is on the way out. And Mr. Trump kind of represents one piece of that here, but they're having the same kind of difficulties in many parts of Europe where right-wing forces are growing up. But it's a decline of the system, and it's better to understand it that way than the individuals. I think if you could put it another way, the people who largely were appealed to by Donald Trump, in addition to using the racial division as a wedge issue, were people who might have been protected by a strong social democratic welfare state. A different trade policy would have helped. They wouldn't have lost their jobs. There might have been better medical care. There might have been better tax situation. There might have been money for schools. All of that is part and parcel of a good liberal or social democratic program, but it didn't happen. It got weakened and got weaker and weaker, and particularly as labor got weaker and weaker. Labor peaked at 34% of the labor force in unions, but that was in 1953. Mm-hmm. It's now down to 11%, and in the private sector, it's only about 5 or 6%. Those are very weak unions. That was part and parcel, by the way, not only of changes in different sectors where unions were powerful, but there was an all-out explicit corporate attack on unions. It was a design to try to weaken their power. Mm-hmm. So-called Powell, the Powell memo of 1973, which was a Chamber of Commerce strategy that was picked up by many, and we now have lots of other examples of the use of big money to reduce labor power, to capture state and national legislatures. That system, I think, is dying.
We have a call. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Robin, and thank you for taking my call. Gar, I'm a great fan of yours, and I'll watch you give lectures on YouTube quite frequently. And trying to create a model like you're talking about, or like the Cleveland model here in Mendocino County. Let's see, what's my question? Oh, I have one more comment, and that is that we have a candidate for governor, John Chang, who is in favor of a public bank, and it's part of his platform. Mm-hmm. And also Fiona Ma and Betty Liu, I think her name is. Betty Yee, yes. All of them are in favor of a public bank here in California, and a state bank would be much better than a county bank, because we were trying to get a county public bank here in Mendocino County. We had a lot of opposition to that. My question is, we have... Our county, you were talking about that it's smaller, you can get action done better We have only 87,000 people here in Mendocino County and only about 45,000 registered voters. And so we can get things done easier than in San Diego County, for example. So how do you think that in our agricultural and mountainous county with issues of water, how do you think we could implement something like a Cleveland model?
Okay. Let's hear what Gar has to say about that. Thank you, Robin.
Well, the I'm thinking the name of the organization, but it'll either come to me or you can check it out and send me a note, and it'll come to me later. In Wisconsin, we're beginning to see semi-rural and rural developments of something that looks like the Cleveland model. So, which is more spread out, but often it uses the same principles, some form of cooperative organization, some cases agricultural is part and parcel of it, and some use of existing public organizations, hospitals and universities and city and state government and county government. All of them buy things. They buy a lot of things. So you can cast your, it doesn't have to be concentrated in one narrow area. It can be applied to more rural and developmental areas. My colleague and the co-founder of the group of the Democracy Collaborative, Ted Howard, just came back from similar discussions in just north of Santa Fe in New Mexico, up near Taos, and beginning to look at what might be done in regions that are not concentrated but might be opened up. The same thing's happening in a different way in parts of Appalachia, by the way. We're at an early stage of exploring how to do this, the same kind of principles in different areas. I really want to encourage you to look into those things and to think of, we need some really good models, and it, not only for the Mendocino area, but it would be very, really exciting for the country if you guys were to pull off a new model that somebody else could learn from and then take to the next stage. But those are the elements, I think. Look at the nonprofits and the government organizations that could be anchors, and then begin thinking about how you might draw together a sketch of a model that would build it and build. And the thing about it is to think about it step by step. What would be the first stage? Where might we be in 5 years? How might we project a longer vision? And people understand that we're trying to build for the future. I'm excited to hear that you're kind of looking into it, even though you're running into the obvious difficulties of doing some of these things. The test of the good organizer is hanging in, as a mm-hmm. friend of mine says.
Yeah, we have another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, my name is Heather, and thank you for your show today. And I was wondering if your guest could talk a little bit about benefit corporations and the role of benefit corporations in transforming our corporate culture as dysfunctional as it is at the moment.
Okay, what about B corporations?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because we're seeing a variety of different forms of ownership. They go all the way from nationalized General Motors, and they come to co-ops, and one of the intermediate steps, which can be applied either to private corporations or to co-ops, for instance, is a benefit corp, B Corp. And they meet the test of having, it depends, slightly different in different states, but good environmental commitments to good environmental outcomes, often some form of commitment to wages and equity in the company, variety of social and other indicators, and you need to be certified as a B Corp so that it's not just, hey, I think I am one, so that there's some quality control. I think that's an intermediate step, because you still have, there's still private companies and still driven by the profits making for the people who own it, but very often it really modifies the what companies do. And it's a way of raising these larger social issues about economics, which is what we're really talking about. Can the economy be moral? And a B Corp is a stepping stone towards that issue. A cooperative might be a little further. A really good neighborhood corporation, which is a geographic form, could be a larger development, which brings the whole neighborhood community in, city, state, region. But B Corps, I think, is a very useful and positive stepping stone in that direction. It's one of the forms of social enterprise that many people use that category as well.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, Manny, this is Jeff.
Hey,
and
Jeff.
It's a very interesting program. And I wanted to ask a question in regard to the AFL-CIO and its complicity with its own downfall. I recall the AFL-CIO was the first to introduce political action committees, PACs, to contribute money to politicians, which the corporations have now made great use of, instead of using the masses of workers. And the second thing, during the decline of the AFL-CIO, it seemed it was spending more time working with the CIA and advancing U.S. foreign policy in Latin America and Europe and organizing American workers. Perhaps you can comment on those.
Thank you for your call.
You know, it is true, at least I have seen studies on the role of the AFL-CIO at a particular time in putting down and, you know, working with the CIA and other to put down kind of radical change in Latin America and elsewhere. Particularly when George Meany was president, that was a dominant pattern. The PAC question is slightly different because I think we would see and have been seeing different ways for corporations to organize money for political reasons, quite apart from the AFL-CIO's use of it. But even though it's true that they were an innovator, but I think the AFL-CIO is changing as well. It's much more progressive than it was at an earlier point. And some of the unions within it are much more progressive still. So I think you have to go piece by piece. But the dominant thing about labor, you know, and we can go back through, you know, past history where there's a lot of mistakes were made and a lot of fights that were fought that were, unfortunately, some of the people I would have liked to see happen didn't win them all. The UAW was very progressive at one point, and so was the SEIU. The dominant thing about unions in the United States is they are under radical decline. They're still important in many states, but they are a weakening force down to, as I say, 6% in the private sector and declining to, I think, 11% overall. So we're in a situation where if you think about building the future, they can be allies at some points. They could be using their pension money to help finance some of these new directions. That's another possibility. They certainly can do great things like the fight for 30, which is many financed, and the wage fights for minimum wage, which SEIU helped finance. So they're allies. But I think the way to think about the future, in my view, is how do we build up entirely new structures along with unions that can begin to generate a different vision and a different reality and lay groundwork. And let me use that term carefully, laying groundwork piece by piece, community by community, is the name of the game. People often think of their own project as my project. It's a great project. Or sometimes I use the term projectism. They get into their own project so much it becomes an ism, my project. Projects are critical. You can't do anything without them. But if you stand back and begin thinking, as we're doing in this conversation, about developing more and more specific projects that have these same themes and beginning to see the development of a culture and a complex and then a vision and ideas, that's the nature of system change, beginning to build out. And it's, you know, it can sound overwhelming, but my mother in the 1940s didn't know anything about feminism. She was a woman of that age who could never believe you could change the role of women. Impossible. That was, she, you know, all of her brothers went to college, but certainly she didn't. That radical change, the most radical change in culture worldwide, I think, was the feminist movement. And it was unpredicted. So that's what we're talking about, laying the groundwork piece by piece for something that can become transformative. Let me put it another way. My heroes are civil rights workers in Mississippi in the 1930s, because that's when the really hard work was done. But they laid groundwork without which you could never have had the 1960s. And I think we're in a somewhat analogous phase where people doing these local projects against hard obstacles, beginning to think about how they might fit together, beginning to generate a vision, beginning to think how we might grow over time, are laying groundwork. That's the hardest part, the most important period, and that's how revolutions take place. The unsung heroes are the ones doing the work now. So I think this is a very exciting period of American history, despite all the dangers and despite the Trump and despite the difficulties, because this stuff is happening on the ground all over the country, and people are beginning to be almost not quite aware that they may be laying groundwork for a whole new system. But many are. Many understand that what they're doing is they're not building a co-op. They are laying groundwork by building a co-op for building a transformative culture and a transformative politics. And that's really exciting historic work to do if you put it in that frame.
Yeah, so although some things do kind of seem like they change overnight or they change rapidly, it's still true that you are laying groundwork, as you say, and you might see the results of that two decades later.
Exactly, or it might happen much quicker in a state like California.
All right.
Because there's so much more possibility there, in both in terms of the demographics of the state, but also the attitudes towards the environment. And, the attitudes, they're strong. The state, California, has a much stronger union base than most parts of the country. It's very interesting. I take California very seriously.
One of the things that you say doesn't really work anymore, if it ever did, is a regulatory approach.
Yeah, I'm very skeptical about regulation. I mean, look, it's better than nothing in most cases, but very often, particularly given the relative power of corporations versus labor, the regulators get taken over largely by the big corporations. Mm-hmm. Now, that's an oversimplification. But the man to read or the researchers to read on this, and it's kind of an interesting thing, and one of them got the Nobel Prize for what I'm about to say, were very conservative economists operating out of the most conservative school of economics, the Chicago School of Economics, in the 1930s. And one of the leaders of that school was a man named Henry Simon, a great what I call an honorable conservative economist. He really was a serious conservative worried about liberty. And the analysis was straightforward, is that the corporations, if they're big and powerful enough to be regulated, often are powerful enough to influence the regulators so that they basically subvert the system. Now, not entirely. Often, some good things happen. But by and large, take a look at what's going on, how oil leases are given out in the Department of Interior. That's looks like a democratic process of some government agency, but peel back the vision and you see who's actually making the decisions indirectly. Or, in the last, there's a huge scandal because they were so close that they were parties and sex and all sorts of things were going on between the corporate leadership and the corporate lobbyists and the regulators. That was an extreme example in that case, but by and large, they're so powerful in terms of their money and their legal talents that their interest. They try to control the regulators. That's their interest.
Right.
So I don't want to over exaggerate it, but that tendency is certainly real.
We have another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, I just want to thank you guys for this really inspiring and hopeful show. I'm just planting parsley, and I don't know much about money or banking, but I really appreciate that you guys are figuring this stuff out and making the world better for us and creating these interesting solutions, given all the challenges and opportunities we have. So thank you.
Okay, and we're going to need parsley, too.
Yeah, thank you for calling it. Let me mention, because I've done a little book on this, which we're giving away free online, and it's called Principles of a Pluralist Commonwealth. And why plural forms of commonwealth, co-ops, land trusts, et cetera, et cetera. And it's available at www.thenextsystem.org/principles. And you can download it if you like. It's available online free. So that's www.thenextsystem.org/principles, P-R-I-N-C-I-P-L-E-S.
And that's your latest book then?
Yes, that's my latest book, and it's kind of a little handbook. It's very short, It's a little handbook, and it talks about a lot of these things we're talking about, lots of examples, discussion of principles. But it's meant to be a short compendium of, you know, I've written several books in this. One's called The Next System, another, America Beyond Capitalism. More recently, What Then Must We Do? You can look up my long, complicated name, Al Perovitz, and find, you know, lots of books that are out there available. But this short little handbook is online and free if people want to get it.
Mm-hmm. And let me mention that spelling again for listeners that want to look that up. It's Gar, G-A-R, last name Al Perovitz, A-L-P-E-R-O-V-I-T-Z. And let's mention a few other web addresses that I have for your work. And one of them is the democracycollaborative.org, and which is the, what do I call it, a parent organization for the project,
yes,
the Next System Project? Okay, and then you have one that you refer people to called community-wealth.org.
That's one that kind of surveys on a regular basis all these emerging developments. It's a kind of compendium, or an ongoing expanding compendium of the kinds of things we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm. So again, to listeners, community-wealth.org. And then I found quite a few dozens of your articles over the last decade or so at TruthOut. That's truth-out.org. And then you can search for the author's name, Gar Al Perovitz, there. And then for the newer technology users, there's a Facebook page, which is the Democracy Collaborative. And there's even a Twitter account, at Democracy Collab, C-O-L-L-A-B, Democracy Collab.
Okay, let's take, oops, I guess they gave up. I was going to try to fit in one last call. It is getting toward the end, though, and I guess they had the same thought.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to do just a little kind of an overview summary, perhaps, which is the, back to the what are people doing issue from the beginning of the program. So public banks, there's the famous over 100-year-old public bank. That's the Bank of North Dakota. And then there's a lot of chatter going on around the country, different places, about developing public banks. But that's chatter still. So that's, you know, we may see a spurt of those any year now. But for right now, they're still in the planning stage and the discussion stage and such.
That's right. I think I mentioned New Jersey,
mm-hmm.
where I think we're going to, because we just elected a governor who's committed
uh-huh.
to it. And I think we'll see that one move pretty fast, because he's not only a New Jersey guy, but he's a Wall Street guy who knows how to do banking.
Oh, great. Okay. I didn't know that. So,
He's very progressive, but he comes out of Wall Street and is one of these odd figures who has got a much more progressive politics than his money making.
Well, there's a rarity, but glad to hear about it. So, so the state of New Jersey, public banking, listeners can keep their eyes on that. Now, cooperatives and worker cooperatives, as far as I know, are growing strong, and you mentioned a few of them, and the Cleveland model, for example, and also that's actively, you know, growing in recent years, is it not?
Yes, it is. Uh-huh.
Okay. Now, land trusts, out here we have some land trusts mostly for ag or rural preservation. So it was interesting to hear about land trusts in residential areas. So that's something new, and I haven't heard of that in California. It sounds like that is, you know, the forefront of that is in some of the other states.
Yeah, the most interesting, I mean, the best example of that, an older one, is Burlington, Vermont, but they're mm-hmm. because they did such a good job on it. So they're very easy to do in theory, but you have to act quickly, because otherwise the developers get in there ahead of you.
Well, there's competition out here for that.
Yeah, one of the things that I thought was interesting is somebody asked you, what do you think about GoFundMe? And what you said was so wonderful. You said, oh, that's a good idea, but somebody had to think it up. And so why don't you go think up something?
That's the spirit of it. I'm glad you like that, because that's what's happening. I mean, people often think, if you look at the book I did, What Then Must We Do?, there's several places where I say, look, here, this is a situation ready for an answer, and somebody's going to come up with an experiment that will show will work and show other people around the country something new. And that's a very exciting thing about this period. This kind of thing's happening all over the country in different ways. People are trying things. There's a movement building, so that's that's a big deal in history.
Mm-hmm. Now, the other movement, you know, a do activity that I find fascinating is the public ownership of utilities. So you mentioned Boulder, Colorado. Now, that was a group just started that due to the need they saw to fight climate change. Is that right?
We got 1 minute left.
Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly how do you, if people ask me, how do you do change? I say, get a half a dozen friends, some pizza, and read some books about this kind of stuff, and then figure out how you can support each other doing one thing locally, and from that, other things happen.
Yeah.
That's how change happens.
Okay. Well, there's an example of work, and that was just in recent years. When did Boulder do that?
Boulder just got, well, they worked, it took them 8 years to get there, but they just succeeded last year in actually consolidating.
Oh, was that recent? Okay.
Yep. So it's very interesting. But they did it. You know, that's how they did it. They just decided, figured it out, learned something, read some books, began talking about how to do it, and said, let's do it, and did it. I mean, that's the way it works.
Okay, great. Well, let's leave it there. Gar Alperovitz, you are a font of knowledge and information about what's really going on with the new economy and the emerging next system. Thank you very much for being our guest today.
Thanks for having me. Let me know what happens.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. You've been listening to Corporations and Democracy, broadcast on the second and fourth Tuesdays from 1 to 2 here on KZYX and Z. The next edition will be in 2 weeks, November 28th, with host Linda McClure. Annie and I will return on Tuesday, December 12th. For further information about what you can do to correct the corporate dominance of our democracy, go to www.thealliancefordemocracy.org. Thanks for listening.